All right, and you're listening to WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch, and I'm here with my co-host, Ron.
Good morning, Fran.
Hi. And you're about to hear Radio Naturopath for the next hour. So we encourage you to participate in Radio Naturopath. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can text us at that same number, 860-486-9487. And you can write us at radionaturopath@gmail.com. So we'd love to hear from you. All right. So we have a lot of good things to talk about. And we did have Tony writing in on radionaturopath@gmail.com, which you can also do. And he wanted to know, what is the deal with magnesium? Is magnesium good for you? Should I take magnesium? What about magnesium? Yeah. So we could we should go on a tear about magnesium.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yes, okay. Magnesium is good. If people were magnesium sufficient, there would be world peace.
I know you have a theory about that.
I do.
Well, it's naturally calm.
Yeah.
It's calming.
Mm. Yes. Mm. So magnesium is very important, and one of the things that happens is when people eat a lot of processed food, they don't get enough magnesium. It's not like, oh my, I wonder why people are magnesium insufficient. It's not hard to figure out. If you see how people eat, this is why people are magnesium deficient. Magnesium is very high in natural foods that are unprocessed and grow straight from the ground. It's especially high in green vegetables. Anything green is going to be high in magnesium. Anything that does chlorophyll, anything that has chlorophyll and does photosynthesis is going to have magnesium in it. Why? Because magnesium is a mineral that is at the center of the chlorophyll molecule. So if something has plenty of chlorophyll, it's going to have plenty of magnesium. And if you're a person who does not eat a lot of vegetables, you're not going to get a lot of naturally occurring magnesium. You can also get magnesium from things like nuts and seeds. But my opinion is that your best bet is to eat your leafy greens. So if you're not doing that, you're going to be magnesium insufficient. So we have many people who've got habits of eating a lot of processed food, so they don't get enough magnesium in. What does magnesium do for you? It's really important. It's probably the most important macro mineral in your body. It helps to stabilize all of the moving parts in your body. So all of your nerves and all of your muscles get stabilized by magnesium. It calms things down. It calms down gates that could otherwise be very excitable. So it makes it so that your nerves don't fire as readily. And that's a good thing if you're tense, if you're stressed. When magnesium gets into your brain, it helps to make you less anxious. Magnesium is a cofactor for a lot of enzymes in the liver that help you with detoxification. So if you don't have enough magnesium, you're not going to detoxify as well. Because magnesium is good for nerve and muscle function, you need to have adequate magnesium to eliminate regularly. So if you don't have enough magnesium, you're going to have problems with both bowel and bladder. So without enough magnesium, you're going to have more spasm and you're going to have more urgency and you're not going to be able to relax and have proper urination. If you don't have enough magnesium, your colon is going to tend to be more spastic and function more erratically, and you're going to be more likely to have symptoms of either constipation or diarrhea or just irritable bowel syndrome. Anything that can be irritable will be more irritable if you don't have enough magnesium. Any part of your body, it can all be traced back to that calming of the muscles and nerves. One place where it's not so much the calming of the muscles and nerves is your bones. Because magnesium is part of the structure of your bones. And often when you're told to take supplements to improve the strength of your bones, you're told to take calcium. And you're told to take calcium, they just say, take some calcium. Oh, and maybe some vitamin D. And you're not told to also take magnesium. And the magnesium is at least as important as the calcium. In fact, I often see people being told to take more calcium than magnesium, and that's wrong. You should be taking less calcium and more magnesium, either a 1-to-1 ratio or slightly less than 1-to-1 ratio of calcium to magnesium. Also, when you go to the drugstore, you'll often get magnesium oxide. Magnesium oxide is dirt, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but the form of magnesium that is found in dirt is magnesium oxide. Now, magnesium oxide is not very well absorbed. It does draw water to it, though, which is great if you're constipated. So if you want to use magnesium as a laxative, you can take a lot of magnesium oxide. It will draw water to it for you, and it'll help you go to the bathroom. It's not really solving the problem because you're not absorbing the magnesium. If you take an absorbable magnesium, the part that you absorb is going to give you regular functioning of your colon, muscles, and nerves. Whereas if you take an excess of magnesium in any form, magnesium is pretty non-toxic because excess magnesium, once you stop absorbing it, it just comes out the other end. And so magnesium is what we call hygroscopic. It gets into your colon and then it draws water to it. So it helps with better elimination. And in fact, magnesium and vitamin C are two things that will do to bowel tolerance for a lot of people, depending on what they're needing. They are both things that help with detoxification. And what you do is you give the person magnesium and have them increase their doses gradually day by day until they get some loose stool. And then once they have the loose stool, you have them back off because you don't want them to have loose stool because you're losing too much water through your stool. And you're also wasting the magnesium or vitamin C, whichever you may be taking. And so once you find that bowel tolerance dose, you back off until you have a normal daily bowel movement, and that'll be your dose of magnesium. So to say, how much magnesium should I take? I have to say to you, well, that depends on you. It depends on each person. And of course, you should be talking to a practitioner about this. You shouldn't, technically, you shouldn't be doing this on your own.
Can you get your magnesium tested?
Yes, you can. You can get magnesium tested a number of ways. You can get blood levels of magnesium. If you get your serum levels of magnesium, that's the amount of free magnesium floating around in your blood, that's going to tell you about how much magnesium you ate. If you take your red blood cell magnesium, that's going to tell you how much magnesium you absorb. And so they both can be useful figures, although I tend to skip to the red blood cell magnesium because why do both? If you're absorbing a lot of magnesium, then obviously you're eating enough to get you to absorb a decent amount of magnesium. So I often just skip to the red blood cell magnesium. So because, you know, the red blood cells were then able to take it up. And if you're magnesium sufficient there, you're going to just be magnesium sufficient everywhere. So that's a nice thing. So magnesium becomes more important the more you move because magnesium is involved in the firing of muscles and nerves. So we talk about how when people get cramps, when people are cramping, that they're probably magnesium insufficient, and they probably are, that you're less likely to cramp if you're magnesium sufficient. If you take magnesium when you're cramping, it may or may not abort the cramp because the cramp has more to do with the overfiring of the nerves. The nerves are less likely to overfire if they're magnesium sufficient in the first place. But if you want to abort a cramp, what tends to work is things that shock the nervous system. So that's when you have your spicy things. Coconut water may not work immediately because coconut water is simply high in potassium, and potassium is calming. And when you take something spicy or shocking to the tongue, like pickle juice or cayenne pepper, or we had a brilliant idea because, you know, when you get a cramp, the thing that you want to do is you want to provide a counter irritant, something that your tongue tastes and sends a signal through your nervous system resetting it. This weekend, we were at the May Day Metric at Cycling Concepts in Glastonbury, and we had a great time there. And just randomly, there was a big jug of Atomic Fireballs on the table. I don't know why, but I said, Allison, why'd you get the Atomic Fireballs? She said, why not? I'm like, yeah, that's our Allison.
That's our Allison.
Yeah,
yes.
So I had an Atomic Fireball just for fun. And, you know, it's this artificially flavored candy, but it's very spicy. It's very
really
hot. Hot and spicy cinnamon. Mm-hmm. So, and it's kind of big. It takes a while to suck on an Atomic Fireball.
Yeah.
However, if that's what you had, I bet you if you were on a bike ride and you put that in your mouth, it would abort your cramp. So I think a better solution, yes.
Because why?
Because of the spice, the hot spiciness. It's a shock to your nervous system, so it helps to reset your nervous system. The reason that it's believed that the cramp is happening is because of overfiring of the nerve. When you're pedaling a lot, you're doing a repetitive motion so the nerves can get excited so they don't stop firing, and that's why the cramp happens. So when you take your pickle juice or your cayenne pepper or anything spicy, you're shocking the nervous system to calm down that nerve, because that has been shown to work. Pickle juice has been studied to work, and also spicy things. So that atomic fireball might work, but I thought it might be nice, instead of carrying an atomic fireball, to carry little cinnamon hearts. That's something I'm going to start carrying on bike rides. I'm going to get myself a little bag of cinnamon hearts and give them to people to take. If I cramp, I'm going to try it and see if it works, because the spiciness should abort the cramp. And cinnamon hearts are, you know, they're easy to carry, and they're small. They're not enormous like those atomic fireballs. So I thought the cinnamon hearts would be a good thing. The only thing about the cinnamon hearts is if it's a hot day, they might stick together.
Yeah.
And so.
And then they'll be big like the fireball.
Yeah. And so the pickle juice, you know, pickle juice you can carry in a flask, and now they make, you know, you can get pickle juice shots packaged.
Right.
That they're marketing now.
Yeah,
it's
they're
been
like, you know, just a couple ounces or whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, but you don't need much. You shouldn't, if this works, you shouldn't need much. You just need to taste the pickle juice. I had a client who said that she couldn't see herself drinking the pickle juice because she goes running first thing in the morning. It would hit her stomach weird. And I said, you don't have to drink it. You just have to taste it. Just a few drops on your tongue should do the trick. And that's how you do it. But anyway, in terms of the magnesium might not work right away, nor potassium. So if you drank coconut water, it might not work right away, nor the magnesium, because you have to be magnesium sufficient in the first place. So the deal is you want to be magnesium sufficient all the time. That's going to make you less likely to cramp. But if you have an acute cramp, the magnesium might not do the trick. You have to taste something wacky, either pickle juice or something spicy, to abort the cramp in the moment. However, doing adequate potassium and magnesium all the time is going to be helpful. So now there are different forms of magnesium. So when we talk about a salt, you know, when you say salt, like table salt, we think of just salt, sodium chloride. But the word salt in chemistry doesn't just mean sodium chloride. It means the result of a chemical process. When you put together an acid and a base, they combine together and there is a chemical reaction, and you get salts. So when you combine hydrochloric acid and sodium hydroxide, one is an acid. The hydrochloric acid is an acid, and the sodium hydroxide is a base. And so when you mix them together, what do you get? You get sodium chloride and water.
Okay.
And so they're completely harmless. So the hydrochloric acid provides a chloride, and the sodium hydroxide provides sodium. That sodium chloride, there's your salt. And then you have water, which is not, I guess it's not technically a salt because it's not solid. But the sodium chloride is a result of an acid and a base coming together and making a chemical reaction. So salts are results of a chemical reaction, and they're usually neutral. So when you say a magnesium salt, you're talking about the magnesium ion. So in chemistry, you have an element, right? So an element is just it's an atom at its basic level. It's one of the it's a characterizable building block of a molecule. And elements are made, they have internal structure as well, just like a cell has internal structure. They're made of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Usually they're made of neutrons, not always. Hydrogen, basic hydrogen doesn't have a proton. Doesn't have a neutron. Once you start getting hydrogen with a neutron in it, then you get heavy hydrogen. You get deuterium, and then you get tritium, which one neutron, two neutrons. So hydrogen, basic hydrogen that interacts with stuff doesn't have a neutron in it. So depending on the type of the element, it'll have more or less neutrons in it, and it will give you and it'll have a different atomic number, or a different atomic weight, I should say. Anyway, so when you have that element, it will be more comfortable in the world in an ionic state. And what that means, it's going to have all of its electron clouds filled. So when you have a magnesium ion, it's usually positively charged. So for it to be to have adequate electrons, it's going to have a little more charge in terms of its protons than its electrons. So it's going to be happier in that ionic state, and then it's going to go react with other things. All right? So if you have magnesium and it's combined with oxygen, so if you have a magnesium acid and then you have a hydroxyl group that has oxide in it, then you can get magnesium oxide. And magnesium oxide, like I said, it's not very absorbable into the body. But if you take magnesium and you react it with amino acids, then the body gets very interested in absorbing those amino acids because it needs the amino acids for various processes in the body, like detoxification and building of structure. So if you have magnesium glycinate, the body likes glycine. It uses glycine for calming, for structure, for healthy nerve function. So it sees the glycine, and it's glycine is also used for detoxification. So the body has a use for glycine and says, oh, look, glycine. I'm going to take that up and I'm going to use it. And the magnesium ion follows along. So you can get a nice, very absorbable source of magnesium. And then the glycine is going to do nice things for you as well. You can take magnesium citrate. Now, magnesium citrate is known because if you take too much of it, it's used as a laxative. But if you take a reasonable amount of magnesium citrate, you'll absorb it. Why? Because the citrate is part of the citric acid cycle. The citric acid cycle, also known as the Krebs cycle, is the basic cycle of all of the energy in all of your cells. So your body's like, yeah, give me some of that magnesium citrate. And then if you get magnesium malate or magnesium citrate malate, malic acid, also part of the Krebs cycle. And in fact, people who have a lot of musculoskeletal pain are often found to have low levels of malic acid or malate in their muscles. So for people who have a lot of ongoing muscular pain, we like to give a magnesium malate or a magnesium citrate malate, which tends to be more absorbable than your magnesium oxide and will tend to be more specific for helping with musculoskeletal pain. I have a nice product that's magnesium glycinate malate that has, so you get the benefits of the glycine, the detoxification, and the nerve calming, and then you get the malate, which helps you to calm the muscles and calm muscle pain, and then you get the magnesium in there, which is going to act as a membrane stabilizer. It's going to stabilize the cell membranes of both the muscles and the nerves, and they're not going to be so reactive. So you and your muscles and nerves are going to be calmer. Magnesium is good for you.
So not all magnesium is alike, though, if you're taking like a magnesium supplement, right?
Right.
So you have to make sure it has the components in it to make sure that you're actually going to get absorption.
That you're going to get absorption, and also for the application that you're using. So like I said, that your glycine is going to, if your main thing is that you're anxious, it might be a good idea to use magnesium glycinate. If your main thing is that you have musculoskeletal pain, you might want to use magnesium malate or magnesium citrate malate. If your main thing is that you have a lot of anxiety and you want most of the magnesium to get into your brain, then magnesium L-threonate is a really good one because it crosses the blood-brain barrier well.
It's confusing.
Yeah. Well, that's why you talk to a practitioner. And
right.
They can sort that all out for you.
And they kind of figure it all out.
Yeah.
Sure. Cool. Yeah, I was at one of my customers yesterday, one of my bike dealers, and she's like, discovered, what's it called? Simple Calm. What is it?
Natural Calm.
Natural Calm.
Yes.
Yeah. She's discovered that. And she said it's just been just a world of difference. She loves it. She just loves it. It just makes her feel a lot better.
So Natural Calm is one version of magnesium. And what it is, it comes in a powder. And so the nice thing about the powder is that it doesn't have to have any other ingredients, but the magnesium that's in it. And it's ionized magnesium citrate. So it goes in nicely. I like it when people are willing to do Natural Calm. I like to offer it to them because you can titrate the dose very finely because it's a powder and you can take, you know, eighths of a teaspoon or quarters of a teaspoon. So I'll often tell people to start with a couple of teaspoons a day and then titrate up very gradually, like by a quarter teaspoon a day until they find a dose that works for them. And then back off from there. And again, I'll have them do the bowel tolerance. It's really easy to do the bowel tolerance thing and very finely titrate your dose with the Natural Calm. And so if somebody's finding they take Natural Calm or any magnesium supplement and they feel way better, they probably started out magnesium insufficient.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to look at whether you're eating your veggies or not. And you'll find the more veggies you eat, the less magnesium you'll be able to take. And that's okay, because it means you're getting it from your vegetables.
Right, right. Which brings us to that other point, and that other point being that there's, where does magnesium come from?
Yeah.
Right?
And dirt.
It comes from the dirt, right? The dirt, and it comes from our dark leafy greens,
yes.
Right? That's where we get it.
Well, where does the dark leafy greens get it?
Where do they get it?
Yeah, where they get it from?
From the soil.
Dirt. Yeah.
So
you have to have good dirt, though, because one of the problems is that that the soils are magnesium insufficient because
that's
we have over-farmed. Okay.
That's
because
exactly
we have over-farmed them. And I've talked to Brian O'Hara, our beloved farmer out at Tobacco Road, and he'll tell you all about magnesium insufficient soils. So we have to re-nourish our soils, and the way to do that is by adding magnesium salts and also by using really good compost, because if you put leftover plant stuff back into the soil, it's going to have magnesium. Magnesium doesn't rot. I mean, what rots is organic matter.
Right.
You know, bacteria eat organic matter, but there's still minerals in it.
Right.
And so with the bacteria that are still there in your rotting stuff, the magnesium will be taken up by the bacteria, but you're still putting the bacteria back into the soil. So good compost and mineral salts help to replenish the soils, and you have to be really careful about that.
And
we are so blessed to have really mindful organic farms around us, or I should say, just maybe I shouldn't say necessarily organic, but very, very mindful farmers who really get it about replenishing and caring for the soil. And you will get some of the highest content of magnesium in your vegetables if you go to the farmers in this area.
Right, right. So support your local farmers markets.
Yeah.
Support your local CSAs.
Yes.
Because that's a good thing. Because the real problem here is industrial farming.
Yeah.
So the industrial farming has, they're going over thousands of acres of land with these crops. And then if you don't rotate properly, or if you don't fertilize properly,
right,
then you're going to end up with soil depletion.
Right, and industrial farming, they use chemical fertilizer.
Which is a really bad idea.
They don't do compost, and they don't replenish the soils, and they do what's called monoculture. That's the other problem. So monoculture is where you plant the same crop in the same place every year, and you're not supposed to do that because it depletes the soil, because if you use the same crop puts different nutrients into the soil and uses different nutrients from the soil. So if you are you're planting the same plant over and over, you're going to eventually deplete that soil. And, farmers from way back know that you're supposed to rotate crops. You don't plant the same thing in the same spot all the time, because you're going to, one year you're going to plant something that's going to take this out. The next year you're going to put something there that'll put that back in. And that's what you do.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in monoculture, they don't do that. And those big, amber waves of grain in the middle of the country, big fields of corn,
right,
and wheat and rye going over miles and miles, and year after year the wheat fields are so beautiful under the prairie sky.
Yeah.
Right.
Middle America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's there's all sorts of interesting things in here about the fertilizers that are being used, and pesticides that are being used, and do they have oil in them? And
what kind of oil?
Well, petroleum-based product, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get a I got blocked. That's interesting. You look up one of these things and it gets blocked. What does that mean? There's some sites which will tell you that it does not, that there is not, oil in plant nutrients. And then there are others that say there is. So it's a controversial subject, apparently.
Uh-huh.
But, apparently the oil industry has been hooked into commercial fertilizers and pesticides for a while.
Right.
So you gotta, and if you're spraying that or using that on your garden, that's not good. That's not good.
No.
Plus, it's not going to help your magnesium at all.
No.
So anyway, it's really important that you do, like you said, buy from your local farmer and know what they're doing and ask questions.
Right.
Because people who are really into it, like Brian O'Hara,
they'll talk your face off.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah.
They will. And they'll explain to you exactly how they're doing it, what methods of farming they're using, and it's a good thing.
Yeah.
And I saw one of our local CSAs out working in her fields this morning as I was coming up here.
Yeah.
So
Diane.
Yeah. Diane, yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Yes, R2.
Yeah,
I might have seen her yesterday. Wait. No, I saw her.
No,
anyway.
She's been very busy because it's that time of year. So there's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
But it's really, really
That's
cool.
Good.
So anyway, yeah, you got to watch out. You got to watch what you eat, where you get it from. So if you're buying produce from a big supplier that is, let's say, maybe it's in California, maybe it's out west somewhere, you know, you really need to know whether or not they're doing it right, because you can make things look really green without magnesium.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true.
So be careful.
Yeah. So thanks for that great question from Tony. Okay, did we have another one?
Oh, I've got a few here.
Okay.
Actually.
Good.
I had received a call from Bill from Coventry.
Mm-hmm.
And he had called about, let's see here, about losing brain power after you're like 50 years old.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about, you know, what can you do about that? And of course I Googled it and popped up something about aerobic resistance exercise combo can boost brain power over 50s. But could you talk a little bit about brain power and how to, you know, because it's a scientific fact, we start losing our brain power after a certain age.
Yeah. So I don't know how much of that is actual aging itself, as much as we've been on the planet and we've been exposed to things that can cause neurodegeneration over time. I mean, one of the facts of aging is that your regenerative powers are less, so you need more rest, you know. And if you are in a place in your life, I mean, I know that here I am in my 50s, and I know I don't get enough rest. And I know also that it takes me longer to recover from anything. So if I have a long, busy day, I need more recovery, and I often don't get the recovery. And my work schedule is really not any different than it was 10 years ago. And unfortunately, as you get older, your regenerative powers aren't as great, or they don't happen as fast. You need more time. There are cells that just wear out. And that's what happens over time. And, you know, your ultimate death is because you just, if you don't die of an illness, ultimately your ratio of cells that are no longer functioning has overwhelmed your ratio of cells that are, and the body just can't go anymore. So, and that's how you die. Kind of sad, kind of a somber thought, but there you go. But as you age, you have cells that after a while, they just kind of wear out. And so you're going to have some cells in your brain that are not working so well anymore. And then you also have the fact that the longer you're on the planet, the longer you're exposed to stuff that can cause neurodegeneration. So the longer you're exposed to free radicals in the environment, and free radicals that are the result of your own metabolism. And also, if you eat foods that don't work for you, or if you have stress or whatever, you're going to be exposed to inflammation. And inflammation causes you to raise your cortisol, and cortisol causes degeneration of tissue. So over time, you're exposed to all these things that cause some degeneration. And the longer you're alive, the longer you're exposed to this stuff. And so when you're young, your powers of regeneration are excellent. So you can eat, you know, crummy bread, and and you can extract the essential fatty acids from it and use it and have a healthy brain, or it's easier to do. It's not perfect, because I see children come in, the parents are complaining, they get sick all the time, and they may be very smart and growing, but they get sick a lot, and they don't pay attention, and they're hyperactive. So, I mean, you still are, there's going to be some compromise, but the compromise is going to be much greater when you're older. And so what you need to do, one of the things that's, wait for it, one of the best things for your brain power is rest. So rest is good for everything. When you rest, you regenerate. You have time to regenerate. So if you're never spending time resting and you figure out and your life is, what can I do with this minute to make it productive? You're not going to have as good brain power as if one of your MOs is, what can I do with this minute to make me more productive? And you realize that part of what you need to do is rest, that you can't be going all the time. And I see people who are like, they work until they drop. And then they drop for a while, and then they get up and they do it all over again. And they just keep doing that until they get old. And that's just what people do. People don't feel like they're productive or worthwhile unless they're producing something. And that's a problem, because the counter to that is that if you get rest, you're more productive. We know this from doing interval training, right? You can work harder in your intervals if you get good rest between the intervals. Well, this is true for just accomplishing stuff around the house. And if you want your brain to function well, you need to rest your brain. And how do you rest your brain? You take naps, you go for leisure walks in nature, you go sit in nature, you meditate, you do yoga, you put away the devices, you don't look at TV, you don't look at your cell phone, you don't look at your tablet. You let your brain really rest. Looking at screens is not restful to your brain. Your brain is processing a lot of information, and you have to realize that when you're looking at a screen, is not even the same thing as looking at a book. Because when you're looking at a book, the book is still. It is stable. It is what it is. When you look at a screen is virtual. You're actually looking at pixels that have all been brought together, and they're actually vibrating.
They're always coming at you. They're always stimulating you and coming
at you. Well, and they're vibrating, too. You can't see it, but that's what's going on, because they're electromagnetic. So they're actually moving, and it's not visible to you, but they are. And so your brain, your eyes and your brain are always correcting for that when you're looking at a screen, versus when you look at a book. That's not what's happening at all. You're looking at a book. You're just looking at a piece of paper with letters on a screen. Now, I must say that when you're looking at a website, it's different than looking at an app that's for reading a book. So if you're looking at a Kindle or your Kindle app, or your, you can have Google Books, Amazon Books that you can read. Well, that's Kindle. But there are other apps that are not Amazon that you can read books off of. So when you're reading an actual book where you're scrolling and reading a book on your device, they've got it set up so there's a minimum of vibration. I do find it very relaxing to read a book, even if I'm reading it on my phone or my tablet. I find it pretty much just as relaxing as reading a book that's on paper. So I think they do something to the screen to make it not vibrate so much and to make it more relaxing. And so reading, I think reading is another one of those relaxing things. So there's things you do to quiet your brain so it has time to regenerate. Adequate sleep is one of those, getting naps, getting rest, and then doing things to keep your brain plastic, because your brain does have plasticity. You can learn new stuff at any time in your life. You can be 80 or 90 years old, and as long as your brain is working, you can learn stuff. So your brain can develop new neurons and new connections at any time. So the more you use it, the more you will learn. I mean, I'm in my 50s now, and I feel like I'm smarter than I've ever been. You know, I'm able to make connections better than I ever have been. I just have to keep at it in the other direction and, you know, help to keep myself from the neurodegeneration that will inevitably occur. And I do have that thing where I walk into the room, I forget why I walked into the room, or I forget stuff, or I have to write stuff down. I do have that going on, the short-term memory thing. Mm-hmm. And the short-term memory thing, part of that is an age thing. And part of it is if you're overwhelmed. When you've got too many things going on all at once, your short-term memory can't juggle all those things. And you know that there's no such thing as multitasking, right? Multitasking is not a thing.
It's not a thing.
No, because you can really only do one thing at a time.
That's correct.
If you have three things going, you're toggling. You're going from one activity to the next. You may be going through them rapidly, but your brain can only do one thing at a time.
Right.
So if you think you're multitasking and you're doing three things at once, you're going bam, bam, bam. You're not going bah.
And you're maybe not doing any of them as effectively as you could be if you're just focusing on one thing.
Absolutely. Mm, that's absolutely true.
That's a thing.
So continuing to learn and study also helps your brain to be active. So if you continue to read and learn new things, if you take classes, if you learn anything, if you learn a dance move, if you learn a sport, if you do crosswords, if you do any kind of puzzle that you enjoy, whether it's a crossword puzzle or just a jigsaw puzzle will work too. Any kind of word puzzles or number puzzles. If you like to do Sudoku, that's good too. Any of those is going to help your brain to function better. Having good intellectually stimulating conversations is good. So hanging out with your friends and interacting with them is a good thing. Having human interaction is good for your brain. Just connecting with people is good for your brain. I'm going to go on a limb and saying having intimacy and having sex is good for your brain because those brain chemicals are good for you. They're regenerating and they're calming.
I like the limb you went on.
Yeah.
Mm.
I bet you do.
Yeah.
All right. Uh-huh.
So I went to Harvard Medical School. Well, no, I didn't.
You did?
I didn't go there.
Awesome.
I just went to a website
that
happens
impressive.
To be sponsored by Harvard Medical School.
Oh, that's
Harvard
not
Health
as exciting.
Publications. No, it's not quite as exciting. And fat chance I would get into Harvard. Anyway, they have an article here on their Health Beat section of 7 ways to keep your memory sharp at any age. And guess what the first thing they tell you to do?
What?
Keep learning.
Yeah.
Of course Harvard would say that.
Yeah.
But then again, that's kind of a big DUH. But anyway, keep learning. Higher levels of education are associated with better mental functioning in old age. Experts think the advanced education may keep the memory strong by getting a person into the habit of being mentally active, challenging your brain, et cetera, et cetera. The second one is use all your senses.
Yeah.
Yeah. The more senses you use learning something, the more your brain will be involved in retaining memory. Emotional, neutral images, along with the smell. Yeah, so you want to use all your basic senses, basic sight and smell and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
The third one on the list is believe in yourself.
Aw.
Yeah, it's kind of neat.
So have a good sense of self. In other words, the other thing is, you know what, is bad for your brain, anxiety and depression.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Which brings me to our other message, our other caller, but I'll get to that in just a minute. Number 4 on the list was economize your brain use. So if you don't need to use mental energy remembering where you laid your keys are or at the time of your grandfather's birthday party, you'll be better able to concentrate on learning and remembering new and important things. Take advantage of calendars, planners, maps, shopping lists, file folders, address books, blah, 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 all that fun stuff.
Yeah, and I have a couple of cool apps on my phone. I have Color Note, and Color Note is kind of cool because it can you can log into it as an account. And when you log it into it as an account, it will save it. And so you can access it from whatever device will upload Color Note. And so if you get a new phone, your Color Note will be preserved. And so that's a nice one. And it's like Post-its. It's like a big Post-it. And you can create new notes. And the notes, you can make them
there
different colors.
There are so many of those things.
Oh, yeah. And then there's Google Keep. And Google Keep is very nice. Google Keep is cool. It makes lists that are tiles.
Mm-hmm.
And I like those because you can slide those away. You can make checklists or you can just make it can just be text, and it'll save them for you. It'll archive them for you so you can retrieve them later.
You know what else works really good? What you have right there in front of you besides your phone.
Yes, paper.
Paper and a pen.
I know. Isn't
you can
funny?
Write things down. It really does work.
Yeah.
It really does because apparently, I remember reading this a long time ago, but if you actually write things down, you have a better chance of remembering it than you do if you just hear it. So once you write it down, it then puts another level of memory into your system. Number 5 on their list is repeat what you want to know.
Right. Yeah, I do that sometimes. And one of the things I do is when I when I meet somebody, I meet so many people. I forget people's names.
Right. And the drill is to repeat their name 8 times in conversation.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. But I still find that, like, if I'm seeing them on an occasion, if I don't see them again, and I go back, I'm like, oh, I forgot their name again. So I try to do stuff around making associations. So if they have a name that's a song, so if their name is Amy, I'll be like, I'll look at the person, I'll put their face in my head, and I'll associate with them. I'll go, Amy, what you want to do?
I'll try
to do that, yeah. Something like that. Or if a woman's name is Laura, I'll think about her. I'll look at her face, and I'll associate it with my cousin Laura, because I've had a cousin Laura, since 3 months after I was born, I had a cousin Laura. So I've had my cousin Laura my whole life. So the first Laura I knew was Laura Rothbaum. And so I try to associate her with cousin Laura. And so I do stuff like that. And one of the hardest places I have is the Mansfield Community Center. I go in that locker room. I talk to people all the time.
Mm.
There was a really nice lady in the locker room who I had a beautiful conversation with her about what was going on with my dad.
Yeah.
And then she saw me again. She said, so how was your mom? How are you doing with your dad's passing? And I talked to her again. I didn't know her name.
Yeah. So here's a little drill. Here's
then
a little exercise.
And now I remember her
if
name.
If you're standing there and you're having a conversation with someone and the name hasn't really popped up, it's okay to say your name.
Yeah.
In explanation. It'll help refresh the person standing next to you and not make them feel quite as foolish.
Right.
So maybe that's a drill that we could all learn to practice a little more and not assume that everyone's going to remember. Anyway, number 6, there are 7 items here. Number 6 is space it out. Repetition is most potent as a learning tool when it's properly timed. Mm-hmm. It's best not to repeat something many times in a short period as if you were like cramming for an exam or something like that.
Yeah.
Instead, you want to break it into like once an hour, then every few hours, then every day.
Right.
But spacing out periods of study is particularly valuable when you're trying to master complicated information, such as details of new work assignments, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So spacing it out is a good thing. So
yeah.
You're constantly going back to it, but putting enough space in between it, and then it helps you retain things better.
Right.
I could see how this all works. And the last one on their list is make a, and it's going to mess me up here because it's M-N-E-M-O-N-I-C.
A mnemonic.
A mnemonic.
Mnemonic,
yes.
Is it's a way of remembering, like
kind of like your music thing where you have the musical, but I understand. It's like RICE.
Rest, ice. Well, that's an acronym, and
right.
It is a mnemonic.
But,
it's also
but
an,
it is. It's
yes,
rest, ice, compression, and elevation.
Right. It's an acronym that is a mnemonic that to help you remember it. And then, but a mnemonic doesn't have to necessarily be an acronym. It can be a sentence or a song. So an example of a mnemonic is my mother's usually always right.
Okay.
Yes, it's my mother's usually always right. And what you didn't see,
we're getting a great visual here on the radio.
Yeah, what I did was I put my hand. It's the way you remember the muscles of the arm and the forearm, not the muscles. I'm sorry, the nerves of the forearm. So my I'm putting my hand on my bicep, and mm-hmm. that's where the musculocutaneous muscle is. Mother, I'm putting it on the outside of my arm. That's where the median nerve is. Usually, I'm putting it on the inside of my arm. That's where the ulnar nerve is. I'm putting my hand on my armpit, and I'm saying always. Usually always is not a thing you're supposed to say. It's just for purpose of the mnemonic. But anyway, I'm putting my hand on my axilla, my armpit. So it's where the axillary nerve is. And then right, I take my hand and I stroke it all the way down from my armpit to my hand,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the radial nerve is. So that's so.
And that's important if you need to know your arm.
So Dr. Titrid, my anatomy professor, may he rest in peace, at NCNM, he gave us some great mnemonics. One of the classic mnemonics is to memorize the cranial nerves, and anybody who's been to medical school knows this one. On old Olympic towering tops, a Finn and German vault and hop. or view some hops, either one. And ostensibly, they're talking about beer. Anyway, if they view the viewing hops, they're probably thinking about beer. There's also a naughty one, which I'm not going to say.
You also had a little. You had a back and forth with Dr. Fisher Keller the other day. You guys were doing. You were talking about something, and it was
a there a mnemonic?
Yeah, it was something, but I can't remember.
It's probably a cardiovascular one.
Here's one that it was. Here's one that maybe more people know because anyone who's been associated with music. Every good boy does fine.
Yes.
Right. Which is E, G, B, D, and F on the lines of the treble clef.
Right, those are the lines of the treble clef. Mm-hmm. And my dog has fleas. My dog has fleas. That's how you tune your violin. But that's the my dog has fleas.
Yeah, you
just,
also do ukulele.
It's just
that
a
way
song.
Too.
Mm-hmm. It's just a song to go along with the notes. It's not.
Right.
It's that.
But there's a tone for each of those.
Yes,
yeah.
My dog has fleas. Yeah, that's how you tune your violin or your ukulele.
So
right.
Anyway, that's from Harvard Health, and you know, anyway, I have another piece here. If you want to, I had sent this over to you also, Kim from Fairfield, who I spoke to yesterday. Was
oh yeah, and
effectiveness of
the bass clef is good boys do fine always.
Okay,
right.
of course. Effectiveness of yoga in treating major depression.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah. So
there's a big DUH. Yoga makes you feel better.
Really? Yeah, exactly. Yoga makes you feel better. So. Anyway, I didn't know if you wanted to talk about that at all.
Big shout out to my buddy Ann Falkowski and Matt Falkowski, who run Samadhi Yoga, and to Jennifer Nucci, who has taught yoga in this area for a million years, and Carol Horwell, and Sharon Coriati, and Nanette Tummers, and my goodness, the list goes on. Bill Goodale, all of you beautiful yoga instructors who have made us all so happy. Jude Kochman, love you. So all our favorite, I'm just going to, I'll say them as I think of them. Sharon Shanti, people who I have had wonderful yoga experiences with over the years. Beth Prose, there's another one. So as I think of you, I'll thank you for being, you know, guiding us through wonderful yoga. Anyway, you know, yoga helps you with your mental functioning. And it's there's actually a study that came out. There's a study called Adjunctive Yoga versus Health Education for Persistent Major Depression. A randomized controlled trial was published by Psychological Medicine. And the lead researcher was Lisa Ubelacker. And they're at the Psychosocial Research Department at Butler Hospital, which is a Care New England hospital, and she's also associate professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. So she had a whole team of folks, and they did this nice study, and the purpose of the study was to examine whether hatha yoga meaning. So yoga, when you say the word yoga, you're not just talking about when you go on the mat and you make poses. That's only one facet of yoga. Yoga is your life, and yoga is about living your life in harmony. And there are many paths to yoga. And yoga could be meditation. It could just be mindfulness. It can be different forms of yoga practice. And hatha yoga, hatha is yoga using asanas. Asanas are the poses that you do in yoga. And so hatha yoga is where you do the asanas, and that helps you bring you into balance and the peace of yoga. But it is not all yoga is. Everybody thinks of yoga as I'm going to yoga class and I'm going to go do some stretches on a mat. That's not what yoga is even mostly about. And anyone will tell you that the most important thing in yoga is not the pose itself, it's the breath. So if you need props or assistance or anything to get into a pose, you should use the prop. And the pose is not better if you get into it with more flexibility. Getting into a pose in a place of ease is a wonderful thing. I mean, you can challenge yourself in poses as well and experience sensation, but you're not supposed to hurt yourself in yoga. I mean, I was in yoga. I was in class last week, and I had, you know, Jude, and she was wonderful. And she was doing a lot of hip openers, and I had to wonder, thank you very much, Jude, if she saw me walk in and said, "Ooh, Fran's here, let's do some hip openers," because she rides a bicycle. Or she just was like, today is hip opener day, and I just happened to serendipitously walk in for hip opener day. And she had us doing a pose. I can't remember what it's called, where you, you know, you're in a seated pose and you lay your foot atop your opposite knee. And, of course, my knee is going to be sticking up in the air because I can't get my knee all the way down. So she said, if you have very tight hips, use a block. So I did. I used a block, and it was so nice. Because one of the things is if you're trying to be a tough guy or gal and you try to do the pose without a prop and you're having a lot of trouble even getting into the pose, you're not going to experience the beauty and ease of the pose. So you might as well use use the prop. And, you know, using a block or using a strap or a blanket or whatever you need to use. I've found that in the last couple of years, my knees are a lot more tender and I don't really like being on the straight up mat on my knees. So I've started padding my knees for things that I didn't used to pad my knees for. So I'm meaning I'll use a blanket under my knees and I'll do it for table pose and I'll do it for child pose. Anytime I have to be on my knees for more than a couple minutes, or even if I'm doing a knee down warrior, I put a blanket under my knees as well as the mat. And then I can be in the pose and experience the pose without thinking, oh my God, my knee's killing me. And in yoga class, you're encouraged to do that. And in fact, they'll tell you if you have sore knees, pad your knees, please. You know, it's not, you're not more of a, you don't get points for not taking care of yourself in yoga. In fact, you get points for taking care of yourself in yoga. So that's one of the beautiful things about yoga, especially if you have a good holistic healing yoga practice, that when you go in there, you really feel like you're taken care of. You're taken care of by the if the class has a non-competitive atmosphere, and yoga classes can have a competitive atmosphere, in my estimation, that's not the class for me.
That doesn't make any sense.
But it happens. I mean, people get into very vigorous sorts of yoga and, you know, human nature is what it is. People can get competitive with each other. And one of the wonderful things about when I go to samadhi is that they discourage you from doing that. Don't compare yourself to someone else because you're in your own practice and they're in their own practice. And your practice is just as important and beautiful and healing to you. And also you have to remember that you being at peace in your practice affects other people. When you are in the room and doing practice in yoga community, the more you can experience your practice with peace, equanimity, and joy, the more you contribute to that communal experience. When you look around the room and you see everybody in star pose or goddess pose, and there's all these people in these beautiful poses, it's really moving. It's really beautiful. It's like you're looking at everybody looks different and everybody looks the same. It's like looking at trees in a forest. It's just really beautiful and really healing. And then go do that same thing on the beach. Oh, my goodness. It's really terrific. I'm going to get to do that in a couple of weeks. So I can't wait. So why is it that yoga would make you less depressed? Gee, I don't know. Could it be the breathing? Could it be the oxygenation? Could it be the relaxation? Let's see what they say. They enrolled individuals with current or recent major depression who are receiving antidepressant medication and continue to have clinically significant depression symptoms. Participants were randomized into two groups, those who participate in hatha yoga and a control group who just took part in a health education class. The intervention phase lasted 10 weeks and participants were followed for 6 months after. We hypothesized that yoga participants would show lower depression severity over time as assessed by the quick inventory of depression symptomatology, as well as better social and role functioning, better general health perceptions, physical functioning, and less physical pain relative to the control group. We found that yoga did indeed had an impact on depression symptoms. So they don't really talk about the mechanism, so I have to speculate. And I'm going to speculate that there's a lot of stuff that goes on. What they... So let me see. It's yoga class. It's a hatha yoga class, which means, first of all, they said class. So the assumption there is they're doing yoga in community. So they're not the only ones in the room. It's a class. It doesn't say an individual class. It says a class. So I'm assuming they were in there with a bunch of other people. And so, first of all, you're in community. You're doing yoga with other people. So you're creating this beautiful, peaceful energy, and you're feeding off of each other. That's healing, and that's going to reduce depression. That's going to reduce your cortisol. When you're doing yoga poses, you're breathing. And one of the things about breathing is you're encouraged to do significant breathing. Sometimes you'll be coached specifically. So you'll be coached to do Dirgha breath, which is your three-part breathing, where you're breathing in all of the levels of your lungs, and some will coach it as to three stages or three levels of your lungs, so that you're encouraged to be breathing very deeply. You may be encouraged to do Ujjayi breathing, which is where you make ocean sound, and I'll do it for you now.
Is that a radio breath?
So when you're in yoga class, you'll be encouraged to do Ujjayi breathing, and that's, you're making what they call it ocean sound. And the idea there is it's another mindfulness practice, and it helps you to focus on breathing deeply as well. And then there's other kinds of breathing exercises. There's very specific breathing exercises like Kapalabhati. And Kapalabhati is where you're doing the their panting breaths. And Kapalabhati is very intense. So you take a really big, deep breath and you hold it. And then you go and you do panting breaths out very rapidly. And you might be encouraged to do 30 or 20, 30, 40 of those in a row, and then you take a deep breath in and you exhale them all. And what you're doing there, and there's probably a yogic explanation for it, but clinically what you're doing is you're breathing at a rapid rate, so you're increasing your sympathetic nervous system, and then you breathe in and you let it all go, and you have a follow-up parasympathetic response. So it helps you, you're working your core muscles and you're tightening up, you're having a sympathetic response, and then you let go, and then you have a nice relaxation response that follows that. So Kapalabhati is very good for you in that way. It's very specific. So it kind of sounds like this. I'm not going to do all of them. So you do about, depending on who's coaching, you might
sounds like we're having a baby.
20. Well, if you're doing what you call it, not Bradley, the other method, the one where you do the heavy breathing. But anyway, you do that, and you're and then you follow up by a deep breath with a deep exhale, and you're very relaxed after you do that. And so when you encourage yourself to be in parasympathetic mode, of course, you're going to be calmer. When you're calmer, your neurotransmitters are going to function more at a more level pace, and you're going to be happier. When you go into yoga, you are moving, so you're going to release endorphins. You're in community, so you're going to release oxytocin, which is bonding hormone. All things that can affect your mood, and you're going to have healthful neurotransmitters. Because the yoga brings that state of peace, you're going to increase your dopamine. It brings relaxation, so it's going to increase your serotonin. So all the neurotransmitters that help you be in peace and equanimity are going to get a boost. So I just speculated, because it's not written here. This is an abstract, and that doesn't say here in the abstract. Now, that may say it in the entire study, because I don't have the entire article in front of me. But in the study, in the abstract, it's just suggesting cause and effect, or just what happened. The people were depressed. We put them in a yoga class. They were less depressed. And I'm speculating as to why that might have happened. So I think it's a pretty good speculation. Anyway, so it's been wonderful to be here with you on this, on Radio Naturopath, and it's time for us to go, and I will leave you with our final, the end of our yoga class. Peace be with all of you. Om Shanti Shanti Peace. May the good in me see the good in you. Namaste. And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath.
Yes, we will.
Here on 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs.